How did you react?
I asked, trying not to react to what he had just said.
She was coming back to me. She was coming home.
I didn't say anything, Ethan said. I let her go. I said, okay, fine. Whatever you want, that's what I told her. We agreed that I'd go find a chair in a corner of a lounge somewhere or a bed in crew quarters and let her have the cabin for the night. She said she'd go pack her stuff, and off she went. But then I started thinking about us, about how I didn't want to let her go. As I told you, I love her. And then I was like, is this a test? You know what women are like. They never actually say what. So what then? I said, cutting him off. You went back to the cabin? Yeah, but she wasn't there. Her stuff wasn't either. Well, most of her stuff. She'd taken her suitcase, but she'd left some clothes behind in the wardrobe and some makeup stuff by the bathroom sink. And there was the note. The what? The note, Ethan repeated. For fuck's sake, what note? She'd written me a note. It was stuck to the mirror over the desk. How do you mean, stuck? It was one of those posted things. One of those... I tried to gulp down some air to inflate my lungs. They felt as if they were collapsing. What did it say? What did the note say? That she was sorry, Ethan said. Tell me the exact words. I'm sorry. Signed the letter S.
In block capitals.
Yeah. Wait, how'd you...
What happened to the note? Did you take it?
No, I left to go look for her. Went all over the ship, man, I swear. I searched everywhere. Came back to the cabin a couple of hours later and the note was gone. That was it. I didn't see Sarah again. I tried calling her and texting her, but I never got through. Her phone was switched off. So, Ethan hesitated. Well, I didn't think anything was wrong, you know? I thought she was just mad at me, and that turndown service had taken the note, or it had fallen under the bed and I just couldn't see it, or something.
You didn't report her missing?
Missing? Why would I? She'd just decided not to spend that night in our cabin, and then she got off the ship the next day. I know she did. I checked her swipe out activity.
How?
I know a guy. He let me take a look.
Why did you do that?
To make sure.
What made you unsure?
You, Ethan said. When you called me.
The first time I called you, you thought I was her.
I just saw an Irish number. Figured she was calling to apologize or whatever, but couldn't do it. So when she hung up, or when I thought it was her who had hung up, I called back and got you, and you were screaming about the police and her family and all sorts of shit. It got me worried, so I went to check if she'd gotten off the ship. The system said she had. So I figured, okay, I'm okay here, but obviously after she got off, she didn't go home like she said she was going to, and she's probably off somewhere trying to clear her head. But you're mad as hell. And if you have my phone number, what else do you have? You probably know all about me, and well, if I were you, I would have come straight here to find me and probably beat the crap out of me. Which is exactly what you did. Well, the first part, anyway. And look, I appreciate. I came here to find Sarah, you fucking dickhead. Ethan shrugged.
Doesn't sound to me like she wants to be found, man.
Sorry.
What time was it when you went back to the cabin?
I don't know, 10 or 11. So it was dark?
Yeah, dark.
You didn't notice anything unusual in there? Other than the fact the note was gone, no. Did you find Sarah's phone? No. There's a passenger missing from the ship right now, isn't there? Ethan was momentarily thrown by the change of subject, but then he said that yes, there was. What's that got to do with anything? Who is it? I asked. Do you know the name? All I know is it's some American girl, on a PR trip, so everyone's freaking the fuck out.
So it was Megan.
Especially because of... Ethan trailed off. Well, let's just say everyone's freaking out.
Because of what? What were you going to say?
Just that, there was a murder here on one of the early cruises. Don't repeat this, okay? In the crew quarters, a real bloody one, apparently. Total horror show. One of the tabloids got wind of it, but they didn't have any pictures or names, so it didn't spread. Blue Wave is still holding its breath on it, though. If this girl is actually missing, well, they'll turn on the fans in the shit factory, if you know what I mean.
What do you know about that murder?
Ethan shrugged. What I just said, that's all I got.
A murder in the crew quarters. I wonder whether that could be Sana. But didn't Peter say that Blue Wave maintained she had fallen overboard? Had she really been murdered and they were just covering it up?
What about the girl this morning? I asked. How did anyone know she was missing? I heard someone reported it.
Who?
I don't know. Maybe a crew member. Why are you so interested in her?
I tried to focus, to think.
Did your cabin have a balcony? I asked. The one you stayed in with Sarah, or were supposed to?
Yeah.
Did you go out there when you came back to look for her?
No, but I could see out through the doors.
It was dark. If Sarah were out there, she would have turned on the outside light.
But it was dark out there.
Right.
So someone could have been out on the balcony, hiding.
Like the man who had just finished killing Sarah by pushing her off it.
No.
It could have been Sarah. Hiding from Ethan because she didn't want to talk to him. She waits for him to leave, thinks better of leaving the note, grabs it on her way out, decides she can't come home after what she's done, and sends the note to me instead.
Maybe she was alive. But then where was she?
Will you be here? I said to Ethan.
I'll be around, he said.
Listen, man, I am... sorry. For all this.
Yeah, I turned to leave.
So am I. I had one foot out the door when I thought of it. I turned back around.
Wait a second, I said.
You met Sarah in an office.
Ethan nodded.
Which office?
Her office. Anna Buckley.
What were you doing there?
Same thing everyone else was doing. Looking for a job.
But why did you...
It dawned on me then.
Ethan, when did you start work on the Celebrate?
The day before yesterday, technically. This is my first cruise as crew.
What were you doing before this?
Right before this? Managing a restaurant in a Dublin hotel. But I was looking to get moving again and I heard Blue Wave was recruiting through Anna Buckley. That's why I went down there in the first place.
So you weren't here last August? On the Celebrate?
No, man. Ethan shook his head. Why is everyone suddenly asking me that?
I felt my pulse quicken.
Who else asked you that?
Well, okay, he said. Not everyone. But there was this guy in one of the restaurants the first night. A Brit. I thought he was, maybe, you know, checking me out or something at first, because he kept staring at me. But it turns out he just thought he knew me from the last time he was aboard. Last August. But I told him the same thing. I was already out the door.
Romain, Hernonissos, Crete, 2012. It was love at first sight. She was walking in the door of Mikey's place, searching for a face she knew, her pale skin standing out in the darkness, her long golden hair loose around her shoulders. She looked nothing like any other woman in the crowd that night, or any other night for that matter. Romain was mesmerized. He had never experienced anything like it before. An overwhelming warmth in his chest. A desire to touch her, yes. But more than that, too. He wanted to look after her. To be with her. To make her happy. He felt her presence in the room like a torch. And for the entire evening, without any real conscious effort, he kept track of where she was. When she came to get a drink at the bar and smiled at him, he was relieved to be called away by another customer and let Freddy, the new bartender, serve her instead. Romain didn't know what to do, and that made him nervous. It wasn't as if he were a novice. There had been other girls, lots of other girls. He was a strong, healthy, handsome 20-something working as a bartender in one of the most popular bars on the island of Crete. That meant that every evening from April to September he could take his pick. A different one each night if he liked, although, after the initial novelty of it, Romain had quickly learned that there were advantages to being more discerning. But a relationship? He had never managed to talk himself into one of those, and no one else had tried to talk him into it either. It was such an odd idea. Having someone who stayed with you all the time, someone who looked after you and who constantly told you how they cared for you, that it didn't seem as if it could ever be real. Until this night. Until this girl. Walking out with Freddy after closing, he saw her outside, smoking a cigarette and chatting with another girl. Freddy nodded toward her. "There's the one that was hanging around the bar all night, here." He punched Romain lightly on the arm. "Watch this." Freddy walked up to the girl and her friend with a confidence that puzzled Romain because Freddy was short, red-haired, and unattractive. He also had a whole arm covered in ugly tattoos, most of which he had done himself or started himself and that later had to be corrected. Lack of artistic merit aside, they were all embarrassing choices, too. Religious shapes, his mother's face. Romain couldn't even begin to fathom that one. And a song lyric from one of last summer's big hits that made little sense when you were drunk enough to dance to it, and no sense at any other time. And yet here was Freddy, striding up to two girls, one beautiful, one ordinarily attractive, with the confidence of a much more attractive man. People puzzled Romain, even now. "Do I know you?" Freddy said. It wasn't clear at first which girl he was addressing, but then he pointed to her, to Romain's girl.
"You look really familiar."
The girl and her friend exchanged a glance.
"Do I?"
she said to Freddy.
"Imagine that."
Romain got the sense that she was just playing along, being polite. Hope rose in his chest.
"We don't know each other?"
Freddy said. The girl shook her head.
"No, I don't think so." "Then where do I know you from?"
He made a big show of thinking about this.
"Oh, wait, I know. From my dreams."
"Really?"
the girl said.
"That's what you're going with?"
Freddy nodded.
"Yep."
"Well, in that case, I'll meet you there later."
The girls laughed, but it took Freddy a second.
"Oh, I get it," he said.
He sounded cheerful.
"Good one."
The girl's eyes flicked to Romain.
"Does your friend have any better lines?"
"Oh, him?"
Freddy gestured for Romain to join him.
"Lines? Sweetheart, he wouldn't know what you're talking about. Luckily, the fucker doesn't need any lines. Have you seen his face?
Ask him yourself, though, just to be sure." Freddy took a step to the right, making room for Romain to stand beside him and address the second girl.
"You know, you look kind of familiar to me, too."
"Hi,"
the first girl said to Romain.
"I'm Zana."
"Hi, Zana," Romain said. I'm Luke. Zanna had come to Crete with friends on a short break from her job in Utrecht, where she was packing bags in a supermarket and saving money to go traveling around the world for a year. But only a week after returning to the Netherlands, she was back in Crete again, standing in the doorway of Mikey's place looking around. This time for Romain. This time she was here to stay. She moved into his room for the remainder of the summer season. In September they found a place of their own, an old holiday apartment with a sea view if you leaned against the balcony railing and turned your head just right. Romain had lost the concept of a home to his childhood. His only concern was a bed to lie in for the night. Now he watched as Zanna piled colorful cushions on their bed, hung framed pictures of them on the walls, and lit candles at night to make the place cozy. She even decorated at Christmas, dragging a potted palm in from the balcony and twisting multicolored fairy lights around its trunk. She baked him a cake on his birthday, wrote in his card that she loved him. She made a home for them, and whenever Romain woke up to her or came home to her or fell asleep beside her, she felt like a home to him. Zanne got a job in a restaurant in town, and Romain was promoted to management at Mikey's. They stayed in bed well into the day, touching skin and stroking hair and kissing lips. They shared dinner at home, then went off to work for the night, before meeting up again in the early hours to party with their friends or to take a bottle of wine to the beach. They argued rarely and laughed often. Zanne told Romain that he made her feel safe. Of course, she always called him Luc when she did that. Romain, meanwhile, felt as though he had lived his life till now in a dark, constricting box. He had no idea that being alive could feel like this. Was this how other people felt all the time? Warm and safe and wanted and worthy? He wondered whether that was why he had been so different before. Maybe everyone had darkness inside them, but this warm love kept theirs from ever coming out. The darkness. Sometimes he wondered whether it was still there. It was all so long ago now. Mickey, the day at the pond. Sometimes he thought about finding an address for Dr. Tanner, sending him a message to let him know that he had been right. The treatment had worked. Jean had just fallen off that backyard gate. But Tanner probably didn't want to hear from Romain, not after what had happened. And anyway, Romain couldn't risk making contact. He was thinking a lot more about Dr. Tanner these days. Being around Zanna, Romain's words and actions all felt as if they came from a deeper place. Before, when he laughed, it was because he had identified a moment when he was supposed to. Someone had paused at the end of the joke, or others were already laughing. His personality had always been a string of learned behaviors, each one discovered, studied, and acquired quite consciously, many of them during Tanner's treatment, a repertoire of reactions he could pull out and display as needed. But with Zanna, it was different. He didn't have to think about what to say or what to do, and whenever he did say or do something, it didn't come from just beneath the surface. It came from deep inside him. He was becoming real. He was really being good. Romantic love, both feeling it and receiving it, was an entirely new experience for Romain. So he didn't know there was a danger in throwing himself into it, in opening his heart wide, in thinking that his life with Zanna was his life forever now. He couldn't have known. And it couldn't last. Certainly not after she told him she was pregnant. Romain said nothing at first. He was too stunned.
I know we didn't plan this, Zanna said, but it's happened, and it's not like we're teenagers, Luke. I'm 23. I can have a baby if I want. Who's to say I can't? And wouldn't it be nice, a little person that we made together? We'd be a family.
Family. The word stung Roma's heart. "I know," Zana went on, "money. Yes, we probably can't afford to raise a child right now, but we have 8 months to go, and I've been talking to Paul at the restaurant, and he said there'll be a bookkeeping job coming up in..." "Zana," Romain said, "you can't do it." "I can learn how to do accounts, Luc. It's not rocket science." "No. I mean, you can't have it." Zana's face fell.
"What? You have to get rid of it. What are you? You just can't have it, okay?"
They were sitting side by side on their sofa. She put a hand on his cheek.
"Luc, I know this is scary, but just listen to me, Zana. You're getting an abortion."
She pulled away from him, her eyes filled with tears.
"I love you, Zana," Romain said. "You know I do, but you can't. You can't have a baby with me."
"Why not?"
"Because there'll be darkness inside it. Because eventually that darkness will get out. Because when it does, you'll make it feel the way Maman made me feel. I can't tell you why, Zana, but there was something wrong with my father. And the same thing was wrong with me before. If you have that baby..." "But you're fine now, Luc. You're perfect. Are you saying you had a disability or something? A disease? Were you sick?"
"No."
"Then what is it?"
"I can't tell you."
"What? Why?"
"Because if I do, you won't love me anymore."
"Oh, Luc, don't be ridiculous."
She moved back to him, let him take her in his arms. She kissed his cheek, whispered in his ear,
"I love you, and there is nothing you could tell me that would change that."
This was a line Romain had heard spoken many times on TV and in movies, or some version of it. It made him ball his fists. It was so stupid. Anyone who would say such a thing had to be willfully ignorant of the things that could happen in this world, of how things could go horribly, irreparably, frighteningly wrong. Zana needed to know how wrong she was.
"Romain Dupont," he said.
"What's that?"
"That's me. That's my real name."
Your real name?"
A nervous laugh.
"Luc, what are you?"
"My name's not Luc. It's Romain."
"No."
Zana started shaking her head.
"I don't understand."
"Romain Dupont,"
he spelled it out for her.
"Look it up online. See if you still love me then."
But Zana didn't move. She just sat there staring at him. Finally, he got up and got the laptop himself, powered it up, typed his name into Google, and pointed to a screen filled with results.
"Here,"
he said, handing the machine to her.
"Tell me if you want any of the French ones explained."
He knew the story Zana was now looking at, because he had done this same thing himself many times. Child killer. No remorse for 14-year-old victim. Devil spawn of Dovieu strikes again. World's first cured violent psychopath murders own brother 24 hours after release. Interpol launches search for Romain Dupont. Disgraced psychiatrist loses license. Mixed in among them would be Romain's listing on a Kids Who Kill website, a link to a so-called true crime book someone had written about the case, and links to YouTube clips of the round of interviews Maman had done right after Jean's death. Zana's hands, resting on the laptop, started to shake.
"I didn't kill my brother Jean," Romain said. "He fell and hit his head while he was trying to get away from me, but the rest of it..."
"The rest is true."
He reached over Zana's arm and clicked on one of the YouTube links. Mama was sitting in an armchair, looking thin and frail, shredding a piece of tissue between her fingers. She looked so old to Romain, and now she would be older still. She spoke so quietly the interviewer had to ask her to speak up. She didn't cry at all. The interview was for a popular documentary channel, so it was conducted in English.
"Tell us," the interviewer said, "about Romain's father."
The woman asking the questions was as old as Maman, but she had lots of makeup on and her hair wasn't gray.
"There's been some speculation in the press."
"I was raped," Maman said flatly. "Working home from work one night, just a few months after Charlie and I got married. I'd stayed in the city a bit later than I normally did, to have a drink with a friend. It was her birthday. And so, although I was taking the same walk home from the station that I had made I don't even know how many times already, that night I was walking the route a good deal later than I ever had. There were no people around, few cars on the roads, but it was such a short distance, 5 minutes at most. I thought it would be fine. Actually, I didn't think much about it at all. I had just turned onto this street where I noticed all the street lamps were out, and I was thinking how odd that was when I heard footsteps running towards me, and then..."
Mama paused here, took a breath in through her nose, steeled herself.
"Take your time,"
the interviewer said gently.
"A man grabbed me. He dragged me backwards behind the garden wall of a derelict house. He hit me several times in the stomach and on the sides of my head to disable me, I suppose. I felt woozy after that, sleepy. Then he dragged me by my hair inside the house."
"How long were you in there?"
"It was light outside when he left."
"Were you conscious?"
"Just."
The interviewer shook her head.
"I can't even imagine."
"I wouldn't ask anyone to."
"Did they ever catch him?"
"I don't know. I didn't report it."
"Why not?"
Maman looked down at her lap, mumbled something. The interviewer asked her to repeat it.
"Because I didn't want my husband to know."
"Why not?"
"It wasn't the right decision, I know. But I was in shock. I was thinking, okay, this happened. I can't change that. But my body withstood it. My mind withstood it. He didn't win. I hadn't let him. Telling Charlie back then, to me it seemed like it would be an infection, that I would let this thing invade my life, let it spread beyond that one house on that one night. So I made up some story about how I'd fallen asleep at a friend's house and then tripped and fell running back home, and Charlie was in a rush to get out for work and he didn't question it. And by the time he got home that evening, I had had a chance to put myself back together, to practice my story."
Maman paused.
"It was foolish of me, I realize now. And no, I should have gone to the police, let them collect evidence, get a description of him. But I was traumatized. That's what was happening to me on a clinical level, trauma. I wanted to push it down, to forget that it had ever happened. I didn't realize that doing so would mean repercussions for me in the long run. I thought I could just forget all about it."
"So you kept it a secret?"
"Yes."
"And then, when you found out you were pregnant?"
"Then..."
Another long breath in through the nose, out again.
Then it was too late for the truth. I couldn't.
Mama's voice cut off in mid-sentence. Zana had closed the lid of the laptop.
Are you okay?
Romain asked. He reached for her, but she shot up from the sofa and went to stand on the other side of the room.
Zana, don't speak, Luke. Romain, just don't speak.
They stayed like that in silence for a long time.
You killed a child,
Zana said eventually. It sounded as if it could be a question.
When I was also a child, yes, I was even younger than he was. Why? He'd been bullying me, and now he was saying things to my younger brother, scaring him. Jean started to cry, and I got mad, Zana. I got so mad. Don't you ever feel like that? Not enough that I would kill someone, no. It was an accident, I didn't mean to. What about the other ones? Your brothers? I told you about Jean. He fell. Mickey.
Romain sighed. That was a very long time ago. He was crying, and my mother told me to make him stop.
I'd seen her walk up and down the room with him, shaking him. I tried to do the same thing, but I was only 7 years old, and I didn't know that what I was supposed to do was gently shake him, and he got a brain injury from his brain moving inside his skull, eating off the front and back. He died a few years ago from an infection. Has there been anything else?
No.
Are you lying to me right now?
No.
How do I know what's the truth? All this time you didn't even tell me your real name.
They fell silent again.
Zana,
Romain said after a while.
The baby. You think it'll be like you?
Yes.
And you think you did what you did because of your father?
Yes, Romain said. Possibly.
What was your mother like?
She wasn't. He sighed. Not like a mother.
But this is different,
Zana said.
This baby was made from love, even if it wasn't real. That was the intention.
It was real.
It still is, Zana. That's why you wouldn't come with me to Breda that time, isn't it? To visit my parents. You couldn't travel.
I couldn't risk it.
Do you even have a passport, ID, a birth certificate?
Romain had gotten into Greece in 2005 on a passport he stole from a Danish guy in Seville. They looked vaguely alike, but it wasn't something he wanted to put to the test in an airport. He had been lucky enough to get through the sleepy guards at the ferry terminal on the way here.
I have a passport, yes, but I don't want to use it unless I have to.
He stood up, went to her. She turned her head away from him, but didn't try to move.
Zana, listen to me. I love you.
He risked touching her. She let him.
All this, it was so long ago. I was just a child. Yes, I should have told you, but what would you have done if I had told you before now? You would have run away. You would have left me. And why?
Because of 1 minute of 1 day,
19 years ago. Because of something stupid I did when I was too young to know that it was. Because of a darkness that I haven't felt since, Zana, a darkness that your love has kept away.
Tears were streaming down Zana's face. Romain pressed his lips gently against her cheeks, trying to stop the flow.
What about the baby?
She asked.
My father. It's not the same. We are not the same. What do you mean? You didn't rape me.
She turned to face him, met his eyes.
And I'm not like your mother. I will love this baby. Our baby.
Romain pulled Zana to him, whispered into her hair.
But it scares me. It scares me too.
She put her arms around him and he pulled her tighter again.
But we can do this. Together. I think we can. But only if there are no more lies. None. Not even little ones. Love isn't just touching and feeling, Romain. It's knowing. Knowing everything. And still having the feeling, even then.
I will never lie to you again, Zana. He meant it.
I love you. I love you too.
He held her until he ached. He didn't know how long they stood there. For the first time in his life, Romain felt like a real person. There was nothing inside that wasn't outside. No dark streak in his core. He had just been young, mixed up, and he had made mistakes. But now he had someone who believed in him, who loved him, who wanted to have a family with him. A proper family, like the one he wished he'd had.
We can do this, Zana had said. I love you too.
But she didn't. It was all an act. Zana disappeared from Crete 3 days later while Romain was on a 10-hour shift at Mikey's. She had somehow found Romain's stolen Danish passport taped to the underside of one of the bed's wooden slats and took it with her. He thought she was at the restaurant, but no. She had been executing the escape plan she presumably began to hatch the moment she saw the search results for Romain Dupont. Everything that had happened since had been a lie. A way for Zana to extricate herself from the situation without getting hurt. Romain understood this now. Had she gone to the police, too? If she hadn't already, she would once she was away.
What about their baby?
They'd had 72 hours to talk about the future, to discuss names and make plans and get excited. Romain couldn't even contemplate the idea of a baby without feeling a strange lump in his throat. Imagine a child, maybe even a son, to whom he could give everything that Maman had denied him, everything she had kept from him because she started regretting her decision to have him the very moment he was born, maybe even before that. A child who would feel about Romain the way Romain had once felt about Papa. But now Zana was gone, and that didn't bode well for the life in her belly. That night, Romain packed a bag, wiped the apartment of any trace of him, and walked into the night, stopping only when he reached the beach. He slept on the sand, and the next morning talked his way onto a fishing boat headed for Essaouira, convincing the captain to stow him away for 500 euro, nearly all the money he had in the world. Romain hated Morocco. Essaouira was dirty and noisy, with bird shit as common there as drunk, sunburned tourists had been back in Greece. The place was infested with seagulls and stank of rotting fish. But he kept his head down and his end goal in mind. Within a few weeks, he had enough money to afford new, better papers and to buy a plane ticket back to Europe. A ticket back to Zana. He knew exactly where she was. He had spent nearly all his days off in Essaouira's internet cafes, searching for her. She hadn't called the police. He had checked day in, day out, for weeks, but had come across no new alerts, news stories or other mentions of himself online, and absolutely nothing tying him to Greece. This gave him a very valuable piece of information. If Zana hadn't told the police about him, it was unlikely she had told anyone else about him either. Romain created a fake Facebook profile using the name of one of the waitresses from Mikey's place, Claire, who apparently didn't already have one. He happened to have a photograph of Claire and Zana, arms around each other's shoulders during a night out a few months ago. He uploaded it as Claire's profile picture, thus establishing a connection to Zana without Zana's knowing a thing about it or having to click anything to authenticate. Then Romain started systematically sending friend requests from Claire to every one of Zana's friends. Some of them accepted them, some didn't. He bided his time. 4 weeks after his arrival in Morocco, a girl named Kelly, who was friends with Zana and Claire, posted a status update about how excited she was to finally be getting on the Celebrate after a month of training. Underneath the status, it read, "With Zana Awilius." Kelly had tagged Zana in her status, an action that millions of people performed on the site every day. She had probably thought nothing of it. Maybe even Zana thought nothing of it, not realizing that Kelly was connected through Claire to Romain. It was all Romain needed. He deleted Claire and determined that the Celebrate was a Blue Wave cruise ship readying for its maiden voyage due to begin the following week. More internet searching returned photos of Zana in a Blue Wave t-shirt on something called Tumblr, and he even found a video she appeared in momentarily on someone else's blog. In one of the pictures of her published online, Zana was helpfully wearing a name tag that, when Romain enlarged the image, clearly read, "Fizz Cocktail Lounge." You could try to protect your own privacy, yes, but you couldn't really count on those around you to do the same. Once he knew where she was, the next part was easy. He booked himself onto the Celebrate and boarded the ship at Barcelona. He had gotten a discounted ticket because this was its very first cruise. His new passport was worth every penny, passing every checkpoint with flying colors. On embarkation day, he went to his cabin, slept for a few hours, and then, as soon as Fizz opened that evening, made his way to Zana. She wasn't pleased to see him.
"I'm not here to make a scene," Romain said to her. "I just want to talk to you. You don't have to be afraid. I won't hurt you. I don't do that anymore, Zana. I wasn't lying about that." "You need to leave," she had said through clenched teeth, trying to keep her face neutral.
A number of passengers were sitting at the bar alongside them. A male colleague of hers stood at the other end of the counter, polishing glasses and watching them out of the corner of his eye.
"Zana, I just want to talk. That's all. 5 minutes.
Go away, or I'll call security."
"What about the baby?"
"Baby?
There is no baby. Romain, I did what you said."
"What did you do?"
"What I had to."
"You mean you..."
Zana looked him right in the eye.
"What choice did I have?"
The bartender started walking toward them. "Everything okay here?" he asked.
"Fine," Zana said. "It's fine."
"Are you sure?" The bartender looked to Romain. "This guy isn't bothering you, is he?"
"No, he was just leaving."
With both of them staring at him, and other passengers turning now to look, Romain turned and walked out of Fizz. He had no choice. After that, he walked the ship for hours, circling every deck several times, thinking about what to do next. He had no loving feelings for Zana anymore. It was as if someone had flipped a switch.
"But the baby." Was she telling the truth about that?
It had been only a few weeks.
Maybe she hadn't done it yet. Maybe she was just lying to him to get him to leave.
Still, a job on a cruise ship seemed an odd choice for a young woman who was pregnant. Before he let her get away again, he had to be sure. The lights went off in Fizz just after 3 in the morning. A few minutes later, Zana emerged alone to pull down and lock the metal shutter that covered its entrance overnight. Romain watched her from a dark corner a few feet away, a nook that housed a little ATM. When she was done, She pocketed the keys and started toward the stairs. Romain followed her up to one of the open decks. It was practically deserted up here, what with the hour and the weather. It was the middle of the night and cold outside, with flurries of rain and a bracing wind. Zana kept away from the brightly lit area by the rail, instead walking in the shadows cast by the lifeboats hanging overhead. Romain followed her from a safe distance, looking for security cameras as he went. After a minute or so, he realized that all the cameras were on the other side of the promenade, on lampposts close to the rail. Zana was intentionally avoiding them and the lights, but why? Then it came to him. Because she was crew. Crew in uniform. She wasn't supposed to be up here at all. And it was the middle of the night. And they were at sea. And no one knew that a convicted murderer named Romain Dupont was even on this ship in the first place. That was how it happened. There was no great plan, no real premeditation. He had intended just to talk to her, or at least to try that first. But then different ideas moved into the foreground of his mind like pieces sliding across a chessboard, coming together, forming a new, better idea. One the darkness really liked. Near the end of the deck, Zana crossed to the rail and leaned against it, looking out. She pulled a pack of cigarettes from a pocket. Romain didn't think Zana was the type to smoke while she was pregnant, but that alone wasn't proof of anything. After checking for cameras pointed her way and for other passengers, and finding neither, he made his move. As quickly as he could, he stepped up behind Zana, threw one strong arm around her waist while wrapping the other across her chest, clamped his hand roughly over her mouth, and pulled her head back. The cigarettes fell into the darkness beyond the rail. Zana didn't get a chance to make a sound. She did, however, begin to jerk and struggle. Keeping his right hand over her mouth and her body locked against his, he ran his left hand down to her abdomen, up under her t-shirt, down inside her waistband, pressed it against her bare skin. She felt the same. If she was pregnant, she would be at least a couple of months along by now, maybe three. Couldn't she be bigger there? She felt the same as she always did, but then it was difficult to tell when she wouldn't keep still. Romain pushed his hand lower, inside the front of her trousers, down over the front of her underwear, and felt the bulge of a sanitary pad. Zana had her period. She had got rid of his baby. What's the point? That was what the darkness wanted to know. It demanded to. It pressed Romain for an answer as he stood there, holding Zana against the railing on the Celebrate's deck, keeping her in an arm lock, the wind whipping at his face, nothing but the abyss of black ocean all around. What's the fucking point? He had spent his childhood trying to please a mother who hated him before he was even born, who should never have had him in the first place, then spent his adolescence doing time for a crime that was really only a moment of madness. Bastien had provoked him. He had been asking for it. Romain was only trying to protect Jean. But Maman didn't see it that way, of course. She even testified against him at the trial, weeping about how she regretted not doing something with him before, back when he hurt Mickey. Then he had agreed to Tanner's experimental treatment and done everything he was told, only to be abandoned by his father and falsely accused of Jean's murder just a day after his release, destroying both his own freedom and Tanner's reputation. Then Zana had changed everything, but now she had changed everything back again. What was the point? There was none. As far as Romain could tell, there never had been. He closed his eyes and let the darkness in, let it crash down on him in waves and splash up against him and cover him, soak him, drench him. It felt warm and comforting like a hot bath. He relaxed into it. He wouldn't resist it anymore.
but darkness was all he had left. Then he opened his eyes, bent at the knees, picked Zana up, and threw her over the rail. All his life, Romain had tried to be good. He was done with that now.
Adam. The signs were there, if you knew, to look for them. Crew members hurried out, eyes solemn above their smiles. Those stationed behind bars, poised beside restaurant tables and managing cash desks, whispered to each other, their expressions serious. Their trademark aggressive friendliness and toothy smiles were dialed back a notch. The number of visible security guards moving through passenger areas seemed to have doubled, and they all strode past with one hand on their radios, anticipating a sudden burst of communication. Passengers who queried why France was getting big in the windows again were taken to one side and spoken to in calm, reassuring tones. There was no anger or outrage, only wide eyes and understanding nods. Whispers about helicopters and the French Coast Guard, a young woman thought to be tragically lost at sea. I saw this happening in every corner while I walked the ship, searching for Peter, moving systematically from lounge to restaurant to store. Then I walked the corridors, took the elevator up a deck, and started again. When I reached the top, I started working my way back down, repeating the process in reverse. But I didn't find him. Meanwhile, the sun sank in the sky. By the time darkness fell, the Celebrate had settled back in the bay of Villefranche, dropping anchor in much the same spot where it had the day before. A PA announcement informed passengers that the ship was dealing with a security issue which would mean a minor delay in the itinerary. Complimentary drinks were being served on the open decks, and if anyone had any questions, they should feel free to approach the nearest crew member. Sincere apologies, circumstances beyond our control, we'll endeavour to keep guests informed of this ongoing situation, and so on. Sarah had had none of this. But then, she wasn't American. Just before 9 o'clock, exhausted by my search for Peter and all out of ideas where I might look for him next, I returned to my cabin. Everything looked exactly as I had left it, except for the deepening dark outside. I turned on a few lamps and checked to make sure. Earlier, I had untied the scarf from the railing, put it inside the plastic wastebasket liner, and stuffed the lot down to the bottom of my bag. I had washed my hands in the bathroom sink afterward, and then left the cabin. Now I retraced my steps with a small bottle of hand sanitizer I had picked up in the Crescent store, hoping it would be enough to remove fingerprints or DNA or whatever else the FBI might find. I wasn't going to let Peter lead them to me. Instead, I was going to lead them to Peter. I swung my bag over one shoulder and went out onto the balcony. I had to get inside Peter's cabin, and if I couldn't go through the main door, well then... Frosted glass privacy screens were all that separated my balcony from those on either side. The screen ran from the floor right up to the underside of the balcony above. The only way to get to Peter's cabin was to go around. I stood for a second, facing my half-open sliding door, looking at my reflection in the glass. Was I really going to do this? I was planning to climb from one balcony to another, 8 decks up on a gigantic cruise ship with nothing below me but open sea. Do you think you can do this? It didn't matter. I had to. For Sarah. And now for Megan, too. Making sure I had a good grip on the railing's top rung, I stepped up onto its bottom rung and leaned as far left as I could. It offered me a view of part of Peter's balcony, but not of his sliding door. Damn it. I would just have to take the chance that he hadn't locked it from inside. If he had, well, I'd cross that bridge, or railing, when I came to it. I stepped up onto the bottom rung with both feet. I tried not to look down or think about not looking down. I tried to put all thoughts of down out of my mind altogether.
I swung one leg over the top of the railing and onto the other side. The outside. If I fell, I would not only fall to almost certain death by drowning, but I might well ricochet off a few things on the way down. Canopies on lower balconies, lifeboat fixtures, the hull of the ship. Don't think. Just fucking do it. I swung the other leg over. I was now clinging to the outside of my balcony's railing, with nothing but air and my death below me. Outside the balcony shelter, the wind had picked up. I couldn't help it. I looked down. The water was several stories below my feet. If I hit my head and so hit the water unconscious, I would have no chance whatsoever of surviving the fall. In the dark, no one would see me drop. They would never find my body. I shuffled to my right, ducked my head around the privacy screen. Peter's cabin looked empty, but then he might just be in the bathroom. I took a breath, held it, and moved my right hand from the railing on my side of the screen to the one on Peter's as quickly as I could. Then I moved my right foot over too. Okay, okay. I exhaled slowly. So far, so good. You're practically halfway there, halfway done. Just keep calm. The gear bag began slipping from my shoulder. The wind was picking up. Before I could think too much about it, I pulled my left hand and leg off the railing, shifted my weight, and tried to replace them on Peter's stretch of railing before I plunged to the sea. My hand caught the top rail okay, but my foot slid off, leaving me with one leg dangling off the side of the Celebrate for a second. A second too long. Somehow, I kept calm, kept my grip, and kept breathing all at the same time. Then, with some effort, I managed to hoist myself back up to a standing position with both feet firmly on the bottom rung of the railing, still on the outside, staring into Peter's cabin. I could see no movement inside. I had done it. I'd made it across. Now I just had to make it in. I climbed over the top of the railing, slowly but steadily, sweating and panting, and then let go, falling back onto the floor of Peter's balcony, spent and exhausted as much from the stress as from the physical exertion. The adrenaline that had fueled me this far dissipated in an instant, and I started to shiver violently. Hold it together. Don't lose it now. I stood up and ventured a peek over Peter's balcony railing. Christ, it was a long way down. I felt sick just looking. I shook my head and turned to try the handle on the sliding door. It gave. Thank fuck for that. I let myself into the cabin. It was empty. I dropped the bag on the floor and took out the blood-stained scarf, careful not to touch it without keeping the plastic bag I'd wrapped it in between the scarf and my skin at all times. I dropped it on the carpet and pushed it under Peter's bed with my foot. Then I stood there for a long moment, thinking. Was I really going to do this? Was this really me? Planting evidence in someone's room? But then, it wasn't planting, was it? It was returning, and the evidence would only be doing its job, tying the right man to Megan's murder. I pictured Sarah's face, smiling at me in the car outside the airport the Sunday morning before last. She had chosen me, Ethan said. She had picked me. I slung the empty bag back over my shoulder and started to leave the cabin the easy way, through the door. But then I saw the white envelope lying on the desk. It was the same envelope I had accidentally pulled out of the wardrobe with the blanket last night, the one that contained Estelle's passport and the fake note. I picked it up now and carefully withdrew the items inside, wanting to see for myself that my memory was correct, that the writing Peter had pretended was Estelle's was the same that I had seen on the archive boxes back at the Beau Soleil Palais. I flicked to the last page of the passport. The note was still stuck in there. I'm sorry. E. It was so obvious now that I studied it. The writing was identical. How could I possibly have missed that? Why hadn't Peter made more of an effort to disguise it? Maybe he didn't normally write in block capitals and had forgotten about the labels on the boxes. Or maybe he thought showing it to me right after sharing his theory about the same man had murdered both his wife and my girlfriend would be effort enough. And he had been right, hadn't he? I didn't hear the door open behind me. I hadn't realized that Peter was back until I heard his voice. Adam, what are you doing in my room? I looked up and saw his reflection in the balcony doors. Peter was standing behind me, his swipe-out card in his hand. He had already closed the door behind him. I turned around. I'm making sure the FBI gets the right man, I said. No response. He just looked at me. I studied his face and saw no emotion in particular. He didn't seem scared or nervous, nor was he angry or threatening. He didn't even seem surprised. He just looked resigned. You killed her, didn't you? I said. His eyes dropped to the floor. Last night, I said. You weren't sick. You were just faking it. But I wasn't faking it. You slipped something into my drink. That's what you did after I left you at your apartment, right? Went and got something to knock me out? What did you give me? Peter didn't respond. Then, when I went to the bathroom, you whispered something in Megan's ear, telling her I liked her but was too shy to say so. We had to bring you back to your cabin, and then, when I started to feel unwell too, she helped me into mine. Once I was unconscious, you let yourself in. You had a key because of the mix-up with the swipe-out cards. You did that on purpose when we boarded, so you would have access to my cabin too. That's it, isn't it? That's how you got in to leave the scarf, to leave the door open. We didn't pick up the extra set of keys until the next day, but that was fine, because the first night you were able to go and hand over your ID and presto, here's a key for the cabin that Peter Brazier is supposed to be staying in, which is actually mine. Then last night, after I was knocked out, you came in and... My voice cracked. You killed Megan. It was the first time I had said it out loud. Bile followed the words up into my mouth. What did you do? I demanded. Push her overboard? What did you do before that? Where did you get all the blood that was on the scarf? How could you even... My voice cracked again. That's what you meant, wasn't it? Back outside the bar, when you said she was perfect. I thought you meant it was great that she could help us, but you meant it was perfect that she was American. Her disappearance would bring the FBI. You told me that yourself. And the FBI are the only people for the job when it comes to catching a serial killer, right? That's what you were talking about with all that shit about doing whatever it takes. Was it just a coincidence that we happened to sit at the same bar as she did that night? That we randomly crossed paths on a ship this size? Still, Peter said nothing. You killed Megan, I said, to find out what happened to Estelle, and you lied to me so you could get on this ship in order to kill Megan. I know about the passport, Peter. I spoke to Becky. I know you found Ethan the very first night, and I know what he told you. He couldn't have had anything